You talked a lot about the loss of a moral consensus and how that kind of led to the explosion in the 60s. I'm curious how you reconcile the fact that the founders of the country assumed that there was going to be no moral consensus and built in all the checks and balances into the system as of 200 years ago. And how does that fit with your assumption that we didn't have a dissolution until the 1960s?
Well, that's a very good question, although I would have to challenge one of your premises, and that is that the founders did not presume that there would be a moral consensus. Quite to the contrary, if you look at the constitutional debate and the Federalist Papers and the arguments at the time, you will see that the founders believed, and John Adams said very explicitly, that our Constitution is designed for religious people, and if there were not that religious value system, it would be wholly inadequate. Those are his words. If you really look at that debate, you will see that there was a given, an assumption, that limited government, as limited as we have, could only succeed if the people had a agreed upon set of values. Now, that's not... people make a great mistake. And if you've read literature or read speeches by Christian leaders or authors or writers who say that this was a Christian country, that's bunk. This was not a Christian country. Most of them were deists. But they were deeply steeped in the tradition of the Judeo-Christian heritage and believed that that would underlie our government. I wrote in one of my books, I think Kingdoms in Conflict, that it was on American soil that the best strains of the Enlightenment and the best strains of Judeo-Christian tradition met. And we formed a social contract, a social compact, based on an assumption of Christian heritage, but in the best tradition of the Enlightenment. Quite a remarkable experiment. And it's worked. But it's certainly dependent upon assumed common values. But you're quite right, the checks and balances were built in. Now, checks and balances were built in, if you read again the debates, because people were absolutely convinced of the depravity of human beings. And that therefore no one could be trusted with unlimited power. And so we would limit power and have a system of checks and balances which would prevent one part of government from assuming too much power over another. That was the way in which we limited government, based not on the assumption that people are good, but based on the assumption that people are bad. And that was the clear consensus of belief until Enlightenment thought, which argued that human beings are basically autonomous, capable of rational thought, and that they can construct their own moral, can conduct moral discourse and construct their own philosophical and moral systems without the benefit of God, because God is dead. That didn't invade popular culture until the 60s in America. Maybe Paul Johnson may be right, maybe in the 20s and 30s, but as I've read history, I think it became widely a popular movement in 1960. And there has been nothing to reverse it, because the cultural pressures are simply too strong. And I don't think people focus enough. There have been very few people who really focused on what the implications are of the cultural shift that was so profound in the 1960s.
You talked about the Cultural Revolution. I noticed that you mentioned nothing of Dr. Martin Luther King during that time, and certainly he was at the head of the moral rights during that particular period. Would you mention...
I certainly will, and I thank you for correcting me on that, because frequently when I refer to William Wilberforce, who led the campaign for the abolition of the slave trade, and ultimately in 1833, the abolition of slavery, I often go on to say that it was Martin Luther King in the United States in the 60s who picked that up. And at the very same time that this society, in the bastions of cultural elitism in America, which would include the Ivy League campuses, very pointedly the Ivy League campuses, were leading the revolution against established values, a black man was standing up preaching the gospel according to Amos. And as a matter of fact, if you want a good book on business ethics, read Amos out of the Old Testament. About the best book on business ethics published. I was waiting for somebody to ask me today, what book on business ethics did you read? And I'd tell you, Amos. He talked about dishonest scales. He talked about not leaving gleanings in the field for the poor. And Martin Luther King used to preach not only the gospel of Jesus Christ, but the gospel of Amos. And we're indebted to him, because at the same time a cultural revolution was taking place, a revolution was taking place of social and political enormous implications, of which he led. And in my book, Kingdoms in Conflict, I credit Dr. King for that.
Okay. I have one other question, too, and that's in reference to W.E.B. Du Bois, you know, who graduated from Harvard here. And as I'm going back and doing the research on his philosophy and his ethics, that's the one thing that I noticed in his dissertation, that he reached the conclusion that America, you know, would never live up to their values and their ethics as was expounded in the Declaration and the Constitution, you know, that it was meant for two societies. And he dealt his entire life dealing with, you know, that two-ness in American life. And it's the consequence of his research and all, you know, his dissertation and all became the first research here at Harvard, you know, to start their whole Harvard Review and all. Which you mentioned, because as I connect what W.E.B. Du Bois was saying back at the beginning of the century and what Martin Luther King was saying, it appears to me that they, you know, were both very ethical in that they stuck to what was immovable, and that was in this country. Back to Adams and Jefferson, we were founded on these principles that somehow we have never lived up to.
Well, King's preaching was clearly, unashamedly, unabashedly biblical.
Right.
And he understood it. And he understood that, you know, all ethics, I mean, ethics, there is no such thing really as ethics. There is a set of conclusions one draws from one's worldview. And if your worldview is that God created us and that there is a God and he is sovereign over history, and that every single human being is created in God's image, then you have a set of principles that become very unyielding. I mean, you can't give on those. They're non-negotiable. If your worldview is purely utilitarian, that is the greatest good for the greatest number. If your worldview is pragmatism, William James, if your worldview is paganism, I mean, that's going to determine your ethics. Your ethics, that is, the ethos you see of life, is going to flow from your worldview. And the worldview of Dr. Martin Luther King was clearly biblical, probably the last popular spokesman of a biblical point of view that was widely received in America. There hasn't been anyone since of a biblical worldview on social and political issues.
Yes, Mr. Colson, I was wondering, do you agree with Madison's remonstrance in terms of his posing that religion flourishes most when freed of government interference, or how do you stand on that?
Madison's argument, what?
His remonstrance that religion flourishes most when freed of government interference.
Oh, well, sure. Madison was writing about the Bay Colony. He was writing about America, about Massachusetts, about this being a theocracy, which, of course, it was. And the great argument of the Virginia delegation, of which Madison was one of their most articulate spokesmen, was that there had to be, Congress had to pass no law with respect to the establishment of religion or interfere with the free exercise thereof. The idea of separation of church and state was something that came along long after the Constitution and has evolved as a matter of law. I mean, it was never intended by the Founding Fathers. But there was to be a clear hands-off by government, either on limiting the free exercise or the establishment, which was much a reaction against what was happening here in Massachusetts as anything else. I happen to be a Baptist, and I happen to be in the Virginia tradition and believe that government should keep its hands totally off. The problem is government has taken its hands off with respect to establishment, but has not taken its hands off with respect to free exercise. And so we really have lost a great deal in the way of the first liberty, and it is the first liberty, make no mistake about it, in the Bill of Rights, the very first. Press would have you believe they got the first, but if you look at it, that's not the way it is. And I think we're in grave danger of misinterpreting what was intended in the Constitution. I think the law has come a long way from what was intended.
You mentioned you visited Soviet Union last year. Was this in relation to start any kind of prison mission there? And did you visit any other ex-communist countries?
Did I visit other communist
countries? Ex-communist countries.
I have not visited other countries. I have not visited other communist countries since we've been ex-communist countries. I was in Romania on a diplomatic mission for President Nixon and visited President Ceausescu. And I have been to a number of Marxist states in Africa. I have not been to Poland, Hungary, Czechoslovakia, or Romania since they overthrew their communist oppressors. I may be going to Czechoslovakia and Hungary this year because our ministry has started there. It started in Poland. We have a Father Sikorski who's doing a spectacular job organizing ministry into the prisons in Poland. So we're really going there. In the Soviet Union, I went as part of an official U.S. government delegation headed by the head of the U.S. Bureau of Prisons. And we visited four prisons, Perm 29, Perm 35 in the Ural Mountains, about 800 miles east of Moscow. We're only a couple of delegations that have been. That's been a notorious political prison where Nathan Sharansky wrote his memoirs, Fear No Evil. And then we visited the women's prison in the Soviet in Moscow and met with a number of Soviet officials. This was just a year ago, exactly a year ago. And had complete access and have complete access now to work in the Soviet prisons. I prefer to call them Russian prisons. I bet you do too.
Sir, it seems given your history, you have you should know fairly well about the fall, having intimately tasted the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. I was curious as to whether you consider the fall a bad thing. I'd like to sort of frame that. And that it seems to me that the only chance to establish values is by the role model and example of the various leaders and so forth, like yourself, who've had a fall. I mean, so how do you frame this?
Well, there are two fundamental approaches for moral instruction, aren't there? There's a Socratic method, which is the one that you follow at Harvard, which is to expose people to all possible options and weigh them out and see which one seems to be right. Or there's what Aristotle would have called the aristocratic model, that is, there's a good life, it's objective, some people live it, and you should learn it from those who live it. I think it's interesting that the Christian view gives you a touch of both, because clearly we have a role model who is unchanging, and we don't have to struggle to try to figure out what is right or wrong because we have someone who lived a sinless life. We can't live it, and so there's a certain tension at the same time. And we have to struggle and learn with one another how to aspire to live that way. And so, in a sense, that embraces the best of both methods. I think there is something to be said, I guess, for having been to the bottom. And the perspective is different there. And maybe Solzhenitsyn said it best for me, at least, when he wrote in Gulag Archipelago 2, having been 10 years in the Soviet prisons, and he said, "Bless you, prison, bless you for being in my life. For there, lying on the rotting prison straw, I came to realize that the object of life is not prosperity, as we are made to believe, but the maturing of the human soul." I'm not sure but what the walls of the Harvard Business School would tremble at the thought that prosperity is not the object of life. But it isn't. And it's not until you've fallen and kind of are broken that you begin to realize there's something more important. At least there wasn't for me. Yes.
Mr. Colson, as one who's been extensively involved in politics and who is also a Christian, do you have any advice for Christians who are thinking of entering politics, or do you have any feelings about why or why not Christians should enter politics?
Well, I wrote a book, Kingdoms in Conflict, which I'd recommend to you if you're seriously interested in politics, because I talk about the problems of power. I talk about how the political process can corrupt. I've talked about all the difficulties of living by a set of Christian ethics while in public office, all the temptations and pressures that come upon a person in politics, the impossibility of living in a society which insists upon deluding itself into believing that there are political solutions to all problems, and so politicians have to promise solutions to all problems, and that's pretty hard for a Christian who knows better. So I've given all the negatives, but having given all the negatives in that book, and you can read them, I would say by all means, if you feel called, go, because the duty of a Christian is to make the blessings of God show forth, as Cotton Mather put it, in all areas of life, and certainly in the political arena as well. Not because you want to impose your political views on anyone else. The job of a Christian in politics is to protect the religious freedom of everybody. Agnostic, atheist, Muslim, Jew, Christian. But at the same time, you can be the kind of role model that this gentleman is talking about in the political process, and you can contend for biblical truth within the system, because that's what pluralism means. We've terribly distorted pluralism. And we've come to take that very noble thought that we could live in a pluralistic society where everybody can contend with their particular point of view against everyone else, and said no one will contend with a point of view that might offend anyone else. And you run into really the emasculation of morality rather than civil moral discourse. And that's what's happened. I mean, the thing that seems to me so ludicrous today on all the campuses in America, I mean, I say all, notable exceptions, is that we think really there is no such thing as a moral law. Go to physics courses and you study physics, and you know there are certain laws, physical laws, law of gravity. You go into your political science course and you know there are certain laws, and there are laws. And we go into moral, what used to be called moral philosophy, isn't moral philosophy at all anymore, and people say there is no moral absolute. It's whatever you find it to be. There's no truth. It's whatever you find it to be, whatever you find it to be. Now, why should that be so in the moral area if it is not so in any other area of life? I'd have trouble understanding. And I would hope as students you would have trouble understanding that if your professor tells you that. You won't be popular, but challenge it. Just see what happens. Yes.
Mr. Coulson, in one of your essays I read once, you upbraided Mario Cuomo for his stand on abortion, where he personally was opposed to it, yet he would politically not touch it. And I really applauded this at the time. However, I was just reading about President Lincoln, and he was personally opposed to slavery, yet he felt the Constitution protected it, and he would not touch it. He eventually did, because the South was in rebellion against the Constitution, and therefore could not claim protection from the Constitution. But those seem like the same type of thing to me, and I don't see the difference.
One fundamental difference.
Okay.
It's a very good question and a very fair question. But there's one significant difference, and that is President Lincoln was making a prudential political judgment, not claiming that one position was a matter of conviction before God. He was saying that he personally opposed slavery, but would not, because he thought the Constitution protected it, try to abolish it. And that's a political judgment. And people in politics make that judgment all the time. That is very different than saying you believe there is a God, you believe His word has been interpreted, you are a member of His church, you profess belief in what God says, but you're going to subject God to a majority vote of the populace. That's sophistry. And the fundamental difference is that Cuomo professed to have that as a matter of conviction before God, and then would not implement it in the political process. I say you have to do what Sir Thomas More did when he was confronted with exactly that same thing, and it cost him his life, and say, if it's my king or my lord, I follow my lord. And Cuomo didn't have the courage to do that. I would respect him either way he came out, but not taking the middle ground. If Lincoln had said that he believed slavery was wrong in his conscience before God, then he was equally wrong, but he didn't say that. Have you ever read Elton Trueblood's book on Lincoln's spiritual life? Yes, it's a great book, and he wrestled with this all the time, and he read the scriptures, and he was going through a real... He didn't assume to have all the answers. Cuomo thinks he has all the answers, and there's a big difference. I've been trying to get Cuomo to debate that for about 4 years, and he did, in writing with me. I have an exchange of letters with him that is just classic, but I can't get him. Because as a good logician, he knows he's absolutely wrong. And finally, in the last letter between us, there was kind of a sense of despair in his writing, because he can't defend his position.
Could you talk about Jimmy Carter and his born again Christian experience on Capitol Hill? Do you think that was part of the reason why he was not? I mean, he served one term in the presidency.
No, I don't think his Christian experience had anything to do with the fact that he only served one term. I didn't know him very well as president. We only had one or two contacts. But I spent a week with him working in Chicago, building homes on the west side of Chicago for some poor families. So we worked next to each other for a week. I got to know him well as an ex-president, and I found him to be a very sincere, very dedicated man. I think he will well deserve the credit for having used his office after he left it for the greatest public good.
I've read a lot recently about this trend in America back to basic values. The cover of Time magazine this week is talking about people returning to the simple life. There was an AP poll in the Boston Globe this morning that was saying that 40% of America says that faith in God is their most important value. Do you have hope for ethics in the 90s in America?
Do I have hope for ethics in the 90s? When families recognize their responsibility early to young people, to teach them that there is an absolute right and there is an absolute wrong. And the morally formative years, as Professors Wilson and Herstein, who wrote a classic book, well, both of them were here at Harvard, about 4 years ago, they wrote a book on the causes of crime, and they found that the basic cause of crime was a lack of moral teaching for young people during the morally formative years of 1 to 6. So when that start, when I see evidence that that is happening, that to me will be the first very good sign. And then when we begin to get rid of the notion in public schools that we can't teach values, because there is no such thing as value neutrality. Schools that claim to be value neutral are teaching a set of values, but there are no values. I mean, the only absolute that some people agree to today is that there absolutely can be no absolutes. I mean, and that becomes an absolute. but it's gotten that silly. So when that begins to change in the schools, then when I see, and I hope this will strike home with those of you who are going to the business community, when I see businesses refusing to sponsor trash on television, that we know causes... I mean, how many of you are familiar with the Code Blue study that was done of young people recently by the American Medical Association and the Association of School Boards? Extraordinary. Showed how we've lost a generation. I mean, the behavioral problems because of what they're being taught or not taught. And I see those changes. And then eventually, when that glorious day comes that Harvard reasserts its historic traditional view that there is such a thing as an absolute truth and that the purpose of education is the pursuit of that truth, and when Stanford and Brown and Brown, my alma mater, may be hopeless, it's too far along without a core curriculum even, so that the idea of education is once again to produce good people, as Plato put it, in order that good people might act nobly, then I'll get hope. When people just start going to church, it doesn't encourage me, because I think 90% today go to church for the wrong reasons. They go to church to be made to feel good. I mean, the object of American life today is not be good, it is feel good. And if the church can make you feel good, that's why people want to go there. So just people desiring that. I think, I don't want to be overly cynical, I do think when people are saying that they're searching for some other value in life, what they're saying is that they've discovered what I found in my life. And that is that I had, by the world's definition, at age 39, just about everything you could ask for. Grandson of an immigrant who grew up here in Boston, who went through a prep school not too far from here, who earned a scholarship to Harvard and had the audacity to turn it down. I've written in my book how much fun I had doing that at the time. That was an example of my pride. And went to Brown. The truth is, which I didn't put in my book, is I have a little better scholarship to Brown. And graduated with all kinds of academic honors and a good successful law practice and limousines and chauffeurs and boats in Chesapeake Bay and friend of the President of the United States, and I found it all empty. I found a great big hole in myself. Blaise Pascal, the inventor of the computer, I guess we'll have to forgive him for that because he did some other wonderful things. Blaise Pascal said once there's a hole in every human being, and it's a God-shaped hole, and the problem is we try to fill it with everything else. Can't fill it except by that which fits that hole. And I found that all those other things were bankrupt and empty and useless and meaningless, and that the only real purpose one finds in life is when you're at peace with the God who made you. And if people are searching for that, then there's great hope.
Can we take one question?
Sure.
Mr. Colson, here at Harvard Business School, the administration and faculty have been making efforts in the past couple of years to begin to develop a curriculum for the teaching of ethics. During our first year here, we spent 6 or 7 weeks as a group going through cases, studying ethical problems that business people face. And throughout the curriculum, we attempt to try and grapple in the classroom with different ethical issues that managers are facing in various cases that are sprinkled throughout the coursework. I'm wondering if you could comment on how you think within a secular university ethics might be taught. I think that's a topic that's of concern to all of the schools here at Harvard.
I am really glad you asked that question, because I was hoping I would find some way to work that in, and I never did. And it's a wonderful one on which to end. And we'll let it be the last question and the last answer. The first thing I would do is go over to Boston College and take a course with a man by the name of Spinello, who's teaching that there should never be such a thing as cultural relativism in the field of ethics. He has written some of the finest stuff on ethics I've read anywhere in the United States, and he's not that far away, and I bet he'd be willing to let you come in and listen to some of his courses, because he's really teaching that there is such a thing as absolutes. There's nothing wrong with what you're doing at Harvard. It's fine. It is teaching you to look at problems and think about them from the standpoint of everybody affected, hoping that there'll be a spark of goodness in you somewhere that will cause you more often than not to make the right decision. And at the very least, to make what will be prudentially the best decision for your business. But I don't believe that's ethics. I believe that is utilitarianism, or it's utilitarian ethics, pragmatic ethics. If Kant were right in the categorical imperative, it would be a very important process, because it would help you arrive at what is really a secularized version of the Golden Rule. Do that which, if universally applied, would be the best for the most people, which is really a form of the Golden Rule, if Kant were right. I stand here as Exhibit A that Kant is wrong, because I don't think we can make that determination. But the process going on at Harvard is a good process. I would encourage it. I have read President Bach's speeches on the subject. I applaud and agree, as a matter of fact, with everything he says. But you'll notice that he says that you're really not teaching ethics. He said you're teaching about ethics and you're teaching how to wrestle with ethical problems. He also makes an extraordinary statement, which he said ethical knowledge does not necessarily lead to better ethical behavior. Derek Bach's speech, I think, is tremendous. Just leaves unanswered the one question. If ethical knowledge doesn't lead to better ethical behavior, what kind of influence has to take place in a person's life in order for that ethical knowledge to then lead to better ethical behavior? And he says there was a time when Harvard taught that and taught it as moral philosophy. But we could no longer do that today because the academy would not accept authoritarian values. Well, if the academy will not accept authoritarian values, you'll never be able to teach ethics. You can teach how to try to arrive at good decisions that have the best implications for the people, stakeholders in your businesses. But you can't really teach ethics. What I would recommend, if anybody wanted to listen, which they probably don't, is that you teach the various historic ethical perspectives. Teach utilitarianism and teach it as utilitarianism. Teach pragmatism, which has its roots on this campus, and teach it as pragmatism. Teach the Judeo-Christian tradition, the Judeo-Christian ethic. Which has some pretty good things in it. You know, even if you didn't want to believe the source of it, you can still say, it's really not a bad idea that you should pay your employees a fair wage. It's really not a bad idea that you have honest scales. It's really not a bad idea that you care for the poor. It's really not a bad idea that you care for one another, that you're willing to lay your life down for someone else. There's some things we can learn from that. And moral philosophy could once again be taught as moral philosophy, not simply the Socratic exercise of attempting to arrive at what you think is truth and somebody else thinks it's truth. Is sort of like having an orchestra, each person in the orchestra playing whatever note he feels like playing. It doesn't make pretty music. But at least let people understand that historically there have been certain transcendent value systems. And let them choose for themselves. I believe in pluralism. I believe the truth will ultimately win out if people understand the option. And I'm afraid on most American campuses today, it is unpalatable and unacceptable to teach what is considered our religious heritage, that somehow that violates our standards of tolerance and civility on the campus, and that therefore people aren't learning what has been historically, and learn natural law. I suppose if I were on a totally secular campus and I found that I couldn't do anything else, I would at least teach what some of the Enlightenment thinkers call natural law. And I think President Bach is suggesting that if you read the speech he gave that was published in the Harvard Alumni Magazine in 1988, in which he talks about the fact that we all could agree that there are certain things, some things that are right and wrong. That's a very radical statement for a president of a leading institution to make today, because a lot of places you couldn't say that. But you expand that out a little bit, and you can at least have a system of natural law that could be taught. I think if you want to teach ethics, you have to teach that there is truth, that there are certain things that are absolutely right, whether they're good for your business or not. And cultural relativism leads to the degradation of human dignity, inevitably. This lady has her hand up, and I don't want to end with somebody with a hand up.
I'm at the Divinity School, and
you what?
I'm at the Divinity School, and I think there's a Jewish tradition and a Christian tradition, not a Judeo-Christian. Is it true that Sonowinak is happily involved, in your view, the acceptance of Christ as your Savior?
Well, I said if you a moment ago that whether you believe the source of the truth, I think that one ought to look at the wisdom of the truth and learn from that wisdom which has guided most of Western civilization, which has historically been called Judeo-Christian. And I would disagree with you that there's a difference. I consider myself grafted onto the Jew as a Christian. That's my particular theology. And we can debate that somewhere else. But I don't really see any difference. I see the law fulfilled in the life of Christ and in Christ. But I think that you certainly can teach that tradition, which most historians believe has been the heart and soul of Western civilization, without insisting that somebody become a believer. Because my insisting they become a believer doesn't make any difference. It's only if God touches their heart anyway. So I don't ever try to. But I can certainly show the way to what I believe to be truth. Thank you. Thank you.
You may have been struck by the fact that most of the questions Chuck was asked had very little to do with a question of ethics. Chuck had expected a heated debate. Instead, students simply took notes. The questions, as college sessions go, were pretty mild. Chuck later asked one of the student leaders of the lecture why the questions had been so light. Were all the students in the hall Christians, he asked. No, he was told, undoubtedly there were many Christians there who agreed with Chuck's arguments. But what about the others? Had they perhaps been overwhelmed by his presentation? Well, that rarely happens on college campuses, especially at a school like Harvard. One student later told Chuck that the reason for the students' silence was that many of them simply didn't know the right questions to ask. Most had never been exposed to issues of moral philosophy and ethics. Well, if that's why those students sat so quietly, then we ought to be seriously concerned. Because those same students are going to be the business and cultural leaders of the next generation. And if one of our most prestigious universities is not equipping them to discern ethical questions of right and wrong, or even to know the language of moral discourse, then it does not bode well for the America of the 21st century.